This is a time to get our minds back to 1948 and the beginning of the...
Do you need that or...
No, I have something here. As we approached the spring of 1948, there was a wage reopener coming. I'm kind of wondering what sort of a mood there was in the union and in the leadership. After all, we had just had a big victory in 46 and 47, and brought in some other very important gains. And were we feeling confident or...
Well,
We're now talking about the moments before the 48 opener, when you had prepared for that event. We had done pretty well in 46. We had done not quite so well in 47. You remember the mood that was in your mind?
I must confess that it's a little difficult for me to recapture my own assessments of the situation as we approached that 46 wage reopener.
48.
I'm sorry, 48 wage reopener. I think it was clear that we were going to have to reopen. And that is much because of what had happened in 47 as for any other reason. And in searching for a basis on which to formulate a position, we were able to use material that the Bureau of Labor Statistics distributed on what it took to maintain a minimum standard of living, average standard of living, and a higher standard of living. That is what it took in the way of income. And by our analysis, it was clear that the packing house workers fell below the amount required even for that minimum standard of living. Now, obviously, there are a lot of other questions that statistical data and the statement I've made don't take into account. Would not have put this equation in a precise relationship to each other. But we did feel that increases were necessary and desirable, and it may well be that there were other unions that were in the process of bargaining, because again, they had been confronted with the same problem we had in connection with the Taft-Hartley law. I can't recall the general, I can recall the political situation based on the passage of the Taft-Hartley law better than I can the general feeling among the membership. But at any rate, we did reopen the contracts, and we did get into negotiations. And I think that rather than go into all the details of what occurred afterwards, which we can take almost verbatim out of our convention proceedings that were held in about June of that year, it might be more useful to indicate some of the factors that exercised important influences on what happened, and why it happened, how it worked out.
First, let's establish your relation with the AFL, with the meat cutters, as you went into this thing. Was there a relationship?
My recollection is that we had talk to them from time to time. I'm not sure that at that time we had any specific commitments from them on what would be done. But I think that was as much because of the fact that we had in on previous occasions tried to deal with them. Found that even if we had commitments, that didn't prevent them from doing whatever they decided they were going to do, which usually was accept less than what we thought we ought to get. And but I don't recall that we had had a lot of detail. I think that I would call and tell Dolnick, who was their chief negotiator in those days, that name is spelled D-O-L-N-I-C-K, what occurred in our meetings, and he might or might not, because he was not an elected official, tell me what had happened in their meetings. In any case, we got into the negotiations in, I think, January of 1948. The opener occurred in January. The negotiations went on for some time, rather a desultory sort of a manner. And with offers, but nothing that we felt was adequate, and at some point, and I think this probably would have been in March, might have been in February, although again I think if we have a look at the convention proceedings for that year, we'll find a closer reference to the precise dates. We were told that the companies had made and the meat cutters had accepted.
I think that was Swift and Company in particular.
That Swift and Company had made and the meat cutters had accepted an offer of 9 cents an hour as a settlement of the wage reopener.
At that particular moment, we were in negotiation with Armour.
I think that's right. I think we were in negotiations with Armour at the time the message came to me on the telephone. We recessed our negotiations, obviously, with Armour. Our people were infuriated. Meat cutters action, but I'm not so sure that they weren't just as furious, if not more so, at the companies, because they felt that the companies had deliberately gone behind our back and made this deal with the meat cutters because they knew they could make a better deal with them than with us, and where we represented the vast majority of the workers in the Big Four, and where the meat cutters in those days had a relatively handful of both of plants and of people, although in Swift's they had more than they did in any of the others, actually, I think, because they had the big St. Louis plant, or what was in those days a big St. Louis plant. Well, there were two plants in St. Louis, and they had only one of them, but that was, I think, the biggest Swift plant that they represented. I don't recall that there was another one. In any case, our people developed a slogan almost of, we won't let the tail wag the dog, and that's what's happening in this situation. We're being asked to accept a deal that the meat cutters made with Swift and Company, and the meat cutters represent only a minority of the people who are affected by this deal. It's wrong for them to have made it, and it was vicious of the companies to have dealt that way. This sentiment spread pretty widely. It clearly led up to a situation in the union where we realized it was going to be necessary to call a national committee in where all the plants that might be involved, national policy committee, whatever we called it, to call that in and to give it an opportunity to make a decision as to where it thought it wanted to go.
This was not an unusual step for the UPW to take, to call it
no,
national policy.
As a matter of fact, I think that we rarely had a strike or major action, or even a threatened strike, without calling a national policy committee. The only question was how big that committee would be, really. I'm not sure at this time whether it involved all the plants or just those that were affected in the reopener. But my hunch is we sent the invitation to all our backing house local units.
Well, we certainly know that Atumwa was there.
Well, Atumwa was there. But I mean, well, we know that all the Big Four was there. I think Rath was there. Morrell was Morrell was a tumbler. No.
High grade, probably.
Yes. My feeling is we had the vast majority of the meatpacking plants represented there. May not have had the branch houses and some of the smaller units, but clearly those significance was there. Now there were all kinds of internal pressures within the union at that point. Some of them carryovers from the convention of 46 when I was elected president, for want of another way of putting it, reflected the so-called left-right conflict some people said existed in the union. I never felt that really was the basis of the conflict. That the conflict really stemmed more from. There's no doubt that there was some of that in the union. I don't mean to gloss that over. There were strong influences of various left-wing groups and conservative groups and that sort of business. But essentially, the basic differences were really one of, I always thought, of social unionism versus, I'm speaking now for myself, this is the way the situation appeared to me. The question of whether or not the union was to be an instrument for social change or whether it was essentially a business organization or business unionism where you function more in the Gompers tradition or where it was only a question of more and more and more, or do you try to do things? It is interesting, and I intersperse this at this point, that one of the things that we started doing after the 48 strike, the one we're leading up to now, I think underlines the importance of the point I just made. One of the things we did immediately after that strike was to set in motion what we called a self-survey of our problems on the matter of discrimination. and our whole position on discrimination became a much more active one, and we had supported integration all the time, and we had refused to sign contracts that didn't provide against discrimination, not only against an employee, but also an applicant ever since I'd become president. But this gave it an additional push, and we hired at that time Fisk University, or I should say, we got John Holt from Fisk University to come in and do the study and to make the report, which is available to anybody who wants it in a book called Equal Employment Opportunity. The foreword, interestingly enough, by Hubert Humphrey.
But in any event.
In any event, these tensions between, by the way, I mentioned that in talking about the kind of coalition that supported my election, there was one group that we called just Milton Packinghouse. Now those broke up into several kinds of factions. There were the militant ones who identified with any militant kind of action of any kind. There were the militant ones that were essentially conservative at heart. They really weren't interested in social unionism of any kind. They went along with the anti-discrimination program because it never affected them. But they were really not disposed to see the union chart new courses or go into new area.
Does any particular and local unions come to your
mind? Yeah, sure, several of them.
That kind.
Yeah, Local 3 in Cedar Rapids at that time was that kind. I would have said that parts of the leadership of Local 8 in Omaha with Fred Romano and Nels Peterson and people like that. John Henry, probably because he was black, was not like that, but he'd go along with these other people. And then there were the kind that were really extremely conservative and would have, under any circumstance, taken whatever the company offered it. And a local like that would have been the Cudahy local in Wichita with the Wheelers, May and her husband leading that local. They wouldn't have argued with the company about anything. Whatever the company had offered them, they would have accepted and gotten it out of the way because they had their own side deals with the management. I've always been convinced of that. I don't mean to suggest that they were necessarily getting paid off in money, but they'd get days off if they needed them.
They could get their
special favors.
The guy went to work on their plea.
Yeah, if they wanted to build somebody up, if they wanted, they could get him to do something the company would go along with. Now, there were groups like that in there, too, so that in this so-called anti-left group, or whatever you want to call it, there was a conglomeration of people, where the Wheelers or the Wichita group, people like that, who would settle on any terms with the company, would not get into a fight if they could avoid it. The other groups were militant as they could be. Cedar Rapids, for example, Omaha, they'd get into a fight almost at the drop of a hat over grievances. They were ready to carry on to do battle, but in this situation, the issue rapidly became one of getting back into the kinds of fight that had grown out of the 46 election when I was originally elected. And the character of the issue became almost as much political within the union, although using broader political questions, as it did a question of where we stood vis-a-vis the company. There were a lot of reasonable arguments that could be made both ways in that situation. It was true that the tail was wagging the dog, and that at some point we had to find a way of making companies understand that they couldn't go behind our back and keep making these deals with the meat cutters, which would just cut our feet out from under us. I think we finally taught them that, but it took a few years before we learned how. This was a real issue, a real argument. On the other hand, there was the question of how long can we keep a strike going in the face of an offer of 9 cents an hour, which, considering the general settlements that were being made around the country at the time, which, as I remember it, was somewhere around 9 to 11 to 12, that kind of thing, it wasn't that bad a settlement. And I am not prepared to say now, in retrospect, and I think I am reflecting the view I had at that time, that if we had been offered 9 cents and not the meat cutters, I know we wouldn't have taken it immediately. I'm sure we would have checked with the meat cutters. And I'm sure we would have tried to jack more out. And I have a feeling that more was there, because the record shows that actually the meat cutters offered to take 7 cents, and it took the Swift research people to point out to them that their arithmetic was wrong and that they were really entitled on the criteria they were using.
What's your authority for that?
To 9 cents.
Where did you get that information? From Swift or from somebody in the...
Well, I'll tell you quite frankly that I had forgotten it completely until I got reading some of this material that we have, and I wouldn't be at all surprised that it's in the official record of our proceedings, that it's a public statement that was made to us. I think that originally it came to us from some of the AFL people. You know, the Amalgamated had plenty of divisions among itself on what it was doing, and there were any number of people who were completely on their National Bargaining Committee who were completely dissatisfied with the way they operated. And by the way, many of those people, those locals, gave us help during this 1948 strike. I can find the source that I'm using for this, but that if that's important.
Not at all.
So it should be said that
we're on.
I don't remember where we left off.
Well, I had just asked if you...
If I knew precisely what the source was, I'll check.
And then you had said that there were amalgamated people who were...
Yeah, there were many, many places this could have come to us from. Even some of the companies could have told us this, because there were people on those company committees that didn't have much respect for some of these characters who they were dealing with. Well, at any rate, the basic point that I want to make in trying to frame the character of the problems that this created for our union is that there were arguments purely on their merits, without regard to any political considerations that could be made on both sides of this issue, where to go. As a practical matter, as a tactical matter, and something that I sensed at the time, and I know that because of the recommendation that I made, but that I obviously didn't realize as completely as I have since, was that you, by turning this down this way, we were putting the companies in an almost impossible position. For them to have given us more than they gave the meat cutters would have unquestionably raised some legal questions, because knowing the meat cutters, I'm sure they would have immediately filed unfair labor practice charges saying that the company was really doing this in order to help us take away their membership. But in addition to that, it had to do, it would put in question how far they could be trusted. Once they make a deal with one union, what do they have to do with another union? And they wanted to keep the meat cutters alive. The meat cutters were a very important instrument for them to use from time to time in their dealings with us. So that, and I think that somehow I sensed that, but I didn't have it thought through as I later on did, because I recommended at this big policy meeting that we not have a general strike in the industry, that we pick one package. Probably were the strongest, and try to put major pressure on that packet. And settle with one of them and then move on to another if we had to, if the others didn't come along. Well, that recommendation was hooted down.
What other options were there?
Well, the only other option would be to accept it or to have a national strike. There were no other options. And the tradition of the union was a national strike. The tradition of the industry, well, I don't know about that. Because I'm not so sure that the strike of 1905 or whatever it wasn't only in Chicago. And I'm almost certain that the strike of 1921, were they all national? The 21 was.
Yes.
But I'm not so sure about 5. Well, I don't know how much was national. You know, there's a question as to how big the industry was then, too. In any event, I felt very strongly that that should be our approach in this situation, and I think now that I felt that strong because I sensed this, these other factors that I had learned early on, that one of the more important elements of negotiations was knowing what you wanted, knowing what you had to have in terms of your own organization. Persistence, patience, and also knowing what the other guy's problems were and what you could expect from him as a response to the pressures you were applying or to the demands you were attempting to satisfy based on what his problems were. And I sensed that this was a problem to the company, but I didn't think it through completely, because I wasn't caught up in this business of the tail wagging the dog too, like everybody else. Our whole board was, even the more conservative members of our board. I don't recall, frankly, that even people like Pittman, later said the union was all washed up.
Yeah.
Even like a guy like Pittman voted against it. I suppose we can find out somehow if there were any no votes, but my impression is that it was a unanimous board until all this heat and argument was generated by that policy committee, which real name-calling took place, and that's where all the tensions and political frictions and issues of left, right, center, not wanting to strike, wanting to strike, where all those things came,
all surfaced.
They all surfaced in there. And that was a meeting that went on for hours until I would guess 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was a meeting that really tore at the very heart of the union.
But was there anybody who was arguing for the acceptance of the 9 cents?
I think I can't answer that because I don't remember, but I think it can be said without any question that those who were opposing a strike action were in effect arguing for the acceptance of the 9 cents.
Regretfully and all
yeah,
that.
Because, well, it wasn't because of a lack of willingness to have a fight. It was just, first of all, they felt, I think, that they were being pushed into this strike by the radicals in the union, whoever they were. And secondly, even though they were mad at the meat cutters, they weren't that mad at them that they were ready to do this. And it was a period of time where a certain atmosphere had been created because of some of the legislation that had taken place and all these other things, and the character of the militancy that had existed in 46 had gone through some real changes.
So they were also arguing that they were incapable of really having a successful strike at their plant.
Some of them were, but I don't think that was general. I think, as a matter of fact, it is interesting to note right here in view of your question that those groups who most vociferously opposed the strike action, those local unions, were the ones who were the strongest in their opposition to going back to work when we went back to work.
Yeah.
They were the same groups. And two of them who stick out most strongly in my mind were Omaha and Cedar Rapids.
Omaha Wilson?
Omaha Armour. Omaha Armour. Omaha Wilson, too. Their opposition had never been as vocal as Omaha Armour. Their people weren't as vocal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons I didn't think of it. But Omaha Armour and Omaha Wilson opposed it, but also Cedar Rapids. And they were the ones who were most vocal in their opposition to going on strike in the first place. I can't say that's true of Omar Wilson. I really don't remember that they stated a position. They probably voted with the Omaha Armour people, but I'm not sure I remember what position they took in the course of it. Well, partially, I think, because the nature of these internal stresses and strains within the union were so strong and had never been resolved. They had existed prior to 42. They'd existed, they had existed in 42, certainly. But prior to that, they'd existed. They existed all through the period of the International Union. They surfaced somewhat as reflected by Stern's withdrawal as a candidate for treasurer. They were present during the Clark administration in one way or another. And they would take forms of a different kind. It was only after 46 that it appeared most frequently in the form of a resolution seeking to amend the Constitution to bar communists, fascists, and whatever else it was from holding office in the Union. And all of those feelings surfaced in the course of this meeting and continued throughout the strike, as a matter of fact. All kinds of rumors spread about the numbers of people going back to work. The strike, as I remember it, went on for about 6 weeks or thereabouts. I don't know if we want to get into happened during the strike.
At this stage,
I want to be sure I don't forget the meeting I had with Pitts from Local 28, just shortly before the end of the strike.
But it okay, thank you. Who were then the leaders of the movement to strike by all means? You recall Volkley on the floor and all that.
I don't recall. A guy like Ed Filliman, for instance, of Ottumwa, Iowa, who had grown up, his father had been a miner all his life. Grown up in the central part of Iowa, which always surprised me, had a lot of mining apparently. And he told me once, if I remember correctly, and I think I do, that until he was 10 years old, he always lived in a tent because his father was on strike almost constantly and he couldn't afford a house. He hated employers with a passion. Strangely enough, he did not have, so far as I know, any philosophical ideology.
I'm quite sure he did not.
I'm absolutely certain he was neither a Trotskyite, a communist, none of these things. Not even a socialist. But he had this tremendous hatred of employers. He was one of the more vocal ones. He was the one, by the way, who came up first, as I remember it, with this slogan of the tail wagging the dog. The people who were identified as being on the left, many of the Chicago people like Herb March, although he was a member of the board, but he had other people who were out of their local unions, a guy like Joe Biesenhofer, for instance, who was, I think at that time, president of the Armor Local, which was the largest local in the Union in those days. Many of the local unions out of Tony Stevens' district, Tony, for instance, was for the strike, his was not a political bias. It was primarily because of the meat cutters. He had to teach them a lesson. But locals that he influenced, the Rath local, although I don't remember who there was from the Rath local who did a lot of talking in those days. In any rate, it was then from the East there were people.
Don Smith, probably.
Don, who came out of it. Swift Plant. I'm trying to remember whether Don was on the staff then.
No, I don't think
I'm not sure.
Well,
in 40. Yeah. But there were, I can remember, was his name Harry Offenbach or some such name? He was short and as fat almost as he was high and bald headed with a little mustache. A very sweet, innocent looking guy. The last person in the world you'd think would want to be on strike. But he came out of an area that was pro-strike
tradition.
And had a strike tradition. That's right. Well, they organized some of those plants that way. And by the way, the Sioux City, Iowa plant was one, for instance, which was organized with strike action, too. That is the Swift Sioux City, Iowa. Mm-hmm. So that, and then out of St. Paul, there was tremendous support for the strike. My recollection is that Glenn Shenander, who either then was or later became the leader of the so-called right-wing forces in the Union, I think he spoke for the strike. And a lot of people in those plants were pro-strike.
You don't recall that there was any serious assessment of our ability to maintain the strike.
It was just assumed, I think, that if we called the strike, everybody would go out. Remember the history now.
Yes.
There hadn't been a serious strike in meatpacking since 1921. There had been strikes during the organizing period of the 40s, late 30s and early 40s. But these would be sporadic. They were sit-downs, little short strikes. And they were on the heels of this tremendous upsurge of strike action that occurred with the establishment of the CIO. The first strike, national strike, that had occurred really in 46, after the no strike pledge was out of the way. And in January, and it occurred in that whole wave of strikes that involved the auto workers, electrical workers, the steel workers, and the rest.
And it didn't go too long.
Well, that was when the plants were seized. And that was when once they were seized, we took another look at our position. And although this was the advice I'd given originally, that we would be able to do that. But at that time, our issue should be not a question of a settlement, but a guarantee that whatever a panel recommended would be implemented and put into effect. Because I understood, and again it must have been instinctive because my experience was still relatively limited on a national scene. I understood that you couldn't ask for more than they were able to give you. And they weren't able to set a wage. And so it'd be foolish to ask for a certain amount of money from the government once it took over those plans. But to say to them, whatever that panel that you're going to appoint recommends, you will implement and see that it's put into effect, that we felt we could get by with. And we did. Anderson finally, late that afternoon, capitulated. We got our commitment and our people had won a tremendous victory.
Very heady.
And a strike that had lasted a week or thereabouts was a complete victory. I don't know if it lasted even a week.
And again, it was overturning the Amalgamated Meat Cutters.
No, not yet. No. Well, they would have settled for anything before that. But that isn't when they made their national announcement. They made the announcement that I think you're referring to. After the panel was set up and was already holding hearings, and we'd been called into Washington for final arguments. That's when Gorman came out with a public statement to the effect, or just before he went to Washington, he came out with a public statement, he and Jimerson, that they would accept 15 cents an hour, even though steel had gotten 17 or 18, autos the same, but they were willing to take 15.
Okay. But in any event, what I'm suggesting is that our 48 situation was really building on the kind of a reversal.
That's right, sure.
We had seen the meat cutters reversed.
What had happened then was that I spent until 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning with Ed Witte, arguing the issues with him. Ed Witte was chairman of that panel. I had no assurance from him when I left him. He wouldn't give me any, but I had a feeling that I'd made a dent. And I realized that I had made a dent when at 4 o'clock in the morning I was trying to fall asleep in the Hamilton Hotel where I was staying, and my telephone rang. Who's on the other end of the line but John Dunlop, later all kinds of things, including Secretary of Labor. Then, though, a professor at Harvard and an advisor, Chester Bowles, who was the head of OPA. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, he said to me, "Ralph, when the history of this period is written, you and the packing house workers will be responsible for creating inflation." And so I said to him, "What are you talking about, John Dunlop? You woke me up. You're out of your mind." "Oh, no." I said, "Well, why? What's happened?" He said, "Well, you got that extra penny out of Witte."
Oh.
And that's when I realized for sure that we'd gotten the 16 cents. That is the time we did overturn the meat cutters on that one, because everybody all over the country knew that the meat cutters had agreed to take 15 cents and we'd gotten 16. So our people had under the flush of that. Uh-huh. And then the 46 negotiations, where we had made all those gains and we had carried the ball on that, because what we did in those 46 negotiations was to force the other companies to put many of the provisions that Swift already had in effect in their plants. Swift, because it had followed the policies of the Rockefellers after the Ludlow Massacre thing. You know, they hired Mackenzie King, who later became Prime Minister of Canada, and Swift was, they were one of the first people to introduce a pension plan. And that was the pension plan Swift introduced, the same one. They also put in things like sick leave and that kind of thing. Well, we didn't have that sort of thing in the other contracts. And in 46, one of the major gains was that we put separation. See, we not only put that stuff into the other contracts, but we forced Swift to strengthen there. And that's the time I think we got the 5-day guarantee, which gave us, and we may have even gotten time and a half for Saturday, but I'm not sure about that.
So it was not unreasonable to think, in view of
we could win it.
Yeah, we could hammer it through.
Yeah, it was not unreasonable. And I suppose that in many ways affected my inability to really assess clearly where we were at.
I'm looking, trying to get a reading of where we are on this light, yeah.
Is that good?
Yeah, I guess so. We're almost to an end. We may just as well play the tape out now.
Yeah. At any rate, the strike went on, and I think for 6 weeks, steadily deteriorated.
Would you say something about the management of the strike? What techniques were followed?
Well, there was very little management that was possible because of the nature of it. Some of the companies, like
Swift. No, I'm thinking about our management internal of our